This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. The top U.S. infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, warns that the 40,000 new cases of coronavirus here in the United States now could turn into 100,000 a day if nothing changes. Fauci also told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday he is cautiously optimistic that some useful vaccine could be available in the foreseeable future. Fauci said a vaccine probably won't be available by the time students are due to start school again later this year. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander stressed the importance of reopening schools and called on President Donald Trump and the public at large to wear masks to help prevent further increase in the spread of COVID-19. The White House is blaming intelligence officials who leaked information about an alleged Russian bounty program in Afghanistan for potentially blowing almost any chances of coming to a consensus on whether the threat was real. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany criticized the what she called rogue intelligence officers for putting the lives of U.S. troops in danger while defending the decision not to brief President Trump on what she described as unverified intelligence. Democratic lawmakers expressed concern about the administration's handling of the intelligence and specifically its inclination to downplay the possible consequences. Meantime, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo asked the Taliban to uphold their commitment to cease attacks on American soldiers in Afghanistan. Pompeo was told via the Taliban that the deputy leader reassured him that the Taliban would not allow anyone to use Afghanistan to plot attacks against other nations. This is VOA News. Chief Executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, led the July 1st ceremony Wednesday, marking the 23rd anniversary of the territory's passing from Britain to China amid protests over the enactment.
welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan police are again accused of human rights violation during COVID-19 lockdown.
In terms of the civil and political rights, which are the majority of the complaints that we received as a commission, cases of torture stand at 80%, which is a worrying situation for us as a country.
The United Nations says COVID-19 pandemic threatens global peace and development. Burundi's new cabinet was sworn in on Tuesday. We'll have analysis. Thousands of Sudanese demand justice for protesters killed during 2019 anti-Bashir protests. An Ethiopian security killed 8 or more protesters and arrest many, including Jawar Mohammed.
He was arrested in the center of the city, not far from the country's main stadium. And so far, we have no information
him and his friend, Mere Ragudina is chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, and Equatorial Guinea agrees to stop construction of a controversial border wall with Cameroon. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Kenya National Commission of Human Rights says it documented 10 deaths and 87 injuries resulting from police brutality during the COVID-19 containment period. In a report dubbed Unmasking the State of Human Rights in Kenya During the COVID-19 Pandemic, the commission says police topped the list of state agencies accused of human rights violation during the period. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the commission wants the Inspector General of Police to investigate and publicize all disciplinary actions taken against individual police officers who violated human rights.
The Kenya police have always been on the front line to enforce law and order during curfew hours in Kenya, this time of COVID-19 pandemic, and members of the public have blamed them of violating their rights. The Kenya National Commission of Human Rights Director of Outreach and Research, Anne Okutoi, said that 80% of Kenyans experienced torture during the law enforcement by the police officers during this period.
In terms of the civil and political rights, which are the majority of the complaints that we received as a commission, cases of torture stand at 80%, which is a worrying situation for us as a country. Closely followed by right to life, these are the cases of death that we recorded as a commission during this pandemic, and also issues around access to justice standing at 6%. And according to our statistics, the majority of the complaints were against the state, which ranked at 40% of all claims, with the Kenya police being highest at 59%.
Referring to Kenyans who have been evicted from the public land, especially in informal settlement, Mrs. Anne said that the government went against the law to evict people while fighting the virus, and that the government should suspend any form of eviction during the pandemic.
And I just wish to highlight the worrying trend of the number of evictions and demolitions during this pandemic. So they've actually called specifically on Kenya, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, on the suspensions of all forms of evictions during this pandemic, because we all know the effect that it has in terms of the risk of contracting the virus, but also that it disproportionately targets and impacts women. We saw women being raped during the evictions in Kariobangi.
Activist Wilfred Olal, fighting for recently evicted citizens in Nairobi's Kariobangi slums, said that the government is always threatening human rights defenders and therefore making it difficult for them to fight for the common citizens' rights.
Justice centers, we fully associate ourselves with that report, because some of it has come from the members of the social justice centers. And we continue to call upon the state to make sure that our security agencies are fighting the pandemic and not the people. The rules that we put in place, they must be equal to everyone and not special to others. A lot of human rights defenders have also faced threats, intimidation. Just a few days ago, Mtemi Wakiama was summoned. Personally, I was summoned by the police spokesman.
Most police officers who have been captured on camera harassing Kenyans while enforcing law during the COVID-19 pandemic curfews have been interdicted by the Independent Policing Oversight Authority. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says COVID-19 threatens global peace and development. Michelle Bachelet called for action to protect the world's most vulnerable people at the opening of the 44th regular session of the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Rights Chief says the COVID-19 pandemic has significantly changed the global human rights landscape and profoundly deepened existing inequalities around the world. Michelle Bachelet cites racial and ethnic minorities and indigenous peoples as among those most victimized by the spread of the deadly ailment. Bachelet added, this is particularly true of people of African descent, whom she says continue to face discrimination and unequal opportunities in many spheres, including education and employment. Bachelet expresses dismay at reports of increasing stigmatization, discrimination, and hate speech against minorities and migrants in countries such as Sri Lanka, India, Bulgaria, Haiti, Iraq, and Pakistan. She calls for urgent action to end unjust and violent actions by law enforcement personnel and for an end to the systemic racial discrimination seen in many nations.
Discrimination kills. Depriving people of their social and economic rights kills. And this death and harms damage all of society. COVID-19 is like a heat-seeking device that exposes and is fueled by systemic failures to uphold human rights. Without rapid and decisive national and international action, the pandemic will put an end to hopes to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030.
Bachelet criticizes some countries, including Russia, China, and Egypt, for using COVID-19 as an excuse to crack down on journalists and on freedom of speech and assembly. She warns the pandemic is deepening local and regional threats to peace. Bachelet also notes the human rights and humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen and Syria is worsening as the respiratory ailment takes root.
I'm also concerned that the current grave human rights situation in the Sahel region may further deteriorate as the impact of COVID-19 increases people's suffering, poverty, and grievances. Already armed extremist groups are strengthening their influence over local communities in central and northern Mali, northern Burkina Faso, and parts of the Lake Chad Basin. In South Sudan, COVID-19 could further heighten the extreme vulnerability of its population.
The World Health Organization says more than 10 million people globally have been infected with the coronavirus, and more than 500,000 others have died. The agency warns the worst is yet to come and says the only way to defeat the pandemic is for nations to work in solidarity. High Commissioner Bachelet agrees. She says nations must work together for the good of all. She warns any lack of international cooperation and any effort to prioritize profit for personal or political gain over public health will ensure continued spread of the epidemic, hindering economic recovery. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An Ethiopian opposition leader has expressed concern about Ethiopian security forces' treatment of opposition supporters and pro-democracy groups. Merera Gudina, chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, says the opposition wants to have a say in the way security forces are conducting themselves. His comments came Tuesday after 8 people were reportedly killed and 80 injured during protests over the killing of Hakulu Hundessa, a popular singer known for his political songs focusing on the rights of Ethiopia's Oromo ethnic group. Authorities also arrested pro-democracy activist Jawar Mohammed and shut down his Oromia media network. Gudina says the whereabouts of Mohammed or others arrested along with him were unknown as of late Tuesday.
He was arrested in the center of the city, not far from the country's main stadium. And so far we have no information with him and his friends where they are taken.
He had been leading protests. What was the protest about?
You know, yesterday one of Oromo's what we call best boys was killed or assassinated. So he was trying to organize the funeral of that young guy.
Have you made any contact with the police or the Ethiopian government in terms of why he was arrested?
At least I tried to have contact in the Tetan government, but so far no response.
We also hear that the government has shut down Jawar Mohammed's Oromia network. Is that true?
I think true. That's what we are getting the international part of it, which is operating from the U.S., is airing that the Ethiopian base was closed and it is a staff debate.
Are you comfortable with the election be postponed?
You know, we are sitting with and agree with the postponement of the election, but the problem is, even now, we are at a serious threat. As I told you, the government, the security agencies, law enforcement agencies, the way they are conducting the business of the government, especially the way they are treating the opposition, is very serious. So we want some sort of more inclusive commission that can oversee some of the way the government is conducting its business, including the way the election board is running, the way the security sector is, the army, the police, the militia, the way they are behaving, the way the judiciary is behaving, all sectors of the government, all institutions of the government is not properly functioning, so that's our worry.
Merewa Gudina is the chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 1st. Hundreds of thousands marched in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, on Tuesday, demanding justice for the people killed by security forces during last year's street protest. Protest organizers say they need to keep the pressure on the transitional government despite the ongoing risk of the COVID-19 pandemic. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Demonstrators marched through the streets of Khartoum Tuesday morning, waving Sudanese flags and holding pictures of those killed during the 2019 protests. A similar demonstration took place 1 year ago today, when hundreds of thousands marched to condemn brutal attacks against pro-democracy protesters that left more than 100 people dead. Mustafa Abdullah was among those in the streets Tuesday, demanding punishment for those who attacked the protesters. By WhatsApp message, Abdullah says, despite the health situation, youth are in the streets, marching now demanding justice for the victims of the revolution and to correct the path of the transitional government generally. He says the demands are peaceful and legal, at least in terms of justice for the revolution victims. In April 2019, the military ousted Omar al-Bashir after 4 months of mass protest against his 30-year rule. A military council ruled the country for several months until army leaders and protest organizations signed a power-sharing agreement that created a sovereign council to run the country until elections in 2022. Human rights activist Alzain Othman says protesters want the people responsible for the last year's killings to be prosecuted. He says protesters insisted on marching because they feel the government's reluctance to punish anyone for the killings and the investigations have yet to achieve anything. This year's protest is different from last year's, he says, as last year it was against the military rule and this year it's against even the civilians in the minister's council. Sudan's prime minister addressed the nation Monday on national TV, promising the government will make progress on the justice issue within 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the Sudanese military is out in force, restricting citizen movement, especially on bridges. And in central Khartoum, hundreds of troops and heavy vehicles are surrounding military headquarters and blocking roads linking Khartoum to other cities. Protest organizations called for this march, but ask the participants abide by restrictions to combat COVID-19, like wearing face masks and social distancing. Sudanese health officials have confirmed more than 7,000 active cases of COVID-19. The government says lockdown measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus will end in the first week of July. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Burundian President Evariste Ndayishimiye's new 15-member cabinet, including five women, was sworn in yesterday, Tuesday. The appointment has been criticized because two members are under U.S. or European Union sanctions for alleged human rights violation. Prime Minister Alain Guillaume Bouyoni and Interior Minister Gever Undirakobuka are under sanctions for their alleged role in the violation of human rights during protests against the late President Pierre Nkurunziza's 2015 decision to seek a third term. Lediwe Beckmans is Assistant Professor of African Studies at Leiden University in the Netherlands. She says the inclusion of the two in the cabinet signals that President Ndayishimiye may not be interested, at least for now, in improving Burundi's sour relations with the international community.
I think the people who were appointed in the cabinet, some of them have military backgrounds, and some of them are on sanctions list of the U.S. and the European Union, and they are seen as the hardliners of the former government as well. So the fact that the president appointed these in the cabinet doesn't show that there is a strong willingness to change and doesn't really give a lot of confidence that he might be able to open relations again with the international community, with neighboring countries, search for solutions on how to deal with all these refugees that are currently outside the country. One of my friends from Burundi told me that in his experience in the past, military governments have never really improved the lives of ordinary citizens. So I am a little bit wary of where this might be heading.
Very interesting, because when we spoke last, when Ndayishimiye was being sworn in, there was hope that perhaps maybe he might move away from Nkurunziza's policy, because under Nkurunziza, Burundi was kind of, a pariah country. So now you are saying that it's disappointing with the choice of the cabinet.
Yes, the early signs, and this was already also part in the German inauguration, during the speech. The speech was in Kirunia. I haven't been able to follow it myself, but what I've heard from it is that already in the speech, he was thanking the former president for his 15-year rule and for the foundation he laid therein, meaning in a way that he showing intent to continue to build on this path that the former president had laid down. And with this appointment of the cabinet, of at least part of the ministers of the cabinet with a military background and known as hardliners, that really shows that maybe the hope is diminishing, that's for sure.
He did pick five females to be in his cabinet. What does this suggest? Again, we are looking at Burundi and neighboring Rwanda in terms of women participation in government. How does Burundi fare with the choice of five females in the cabinet?
Well, I think this is, in a way, you can say a very positive sign that gender parity is to some extent on the agenda. And we also see that, like you mentioned, in neighboring countries, there's more gender equality than we see, for instance, in many countries in the European Union or in the U.S. So more high positions for women in government. But at the same time, if we look at discussions of the past, women do not necessarily, if you ask the population, a recent study has shown that if you ask the population who they see as really representing themselves, gender seems to be less important than ethnicity, for instance. In that sense, the appointment of five women in the cabinet doesn't necessarily mean a lot to the population. You can say that maybe it is a sign towards the international community that's showing that they do well on that front, but it's difficult to say at this point.
Equatorial Guinea has agreed to pause the construction of a controversial border wall with Cameroon after talks between the two countries' defense ministers in Yaoundé. The two sides also agreed once again to withdraw troops from their disputed border after deadly clashes left at least seven people dead. An agreement earlier this month to withdraw forces failed to hold, and some border traders are skeptical of this latest pact. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
After a second day of closed-door meetings in Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea's Defense Minister Leandro Bekele Kogu said the two sides agreed to set aside their differences. Kogu on Tuesday announced Equatorial Guinea would pause construction of its controversial border wall which Cameroon's government says violates its territory. He says troops from the two countries that have been deployed to the border will return to their barracks and only come out to protect their civilians in times of crisis. Nkogo says Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea will henceforth jointly combat their common enemies, who are poachers, pirates resurfacing in the Gulf of Guinea, and armed groups attacking and looting civilians in both countries. Kogo said as neighbors, Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea need each other for their security and development. Equatorial Guinea's President Teodoro Obiang Nguema ordered the border wall be built in 2019 to stop Cameroonians and West Africans from illegally entering the country. Cameroon deployed its army to stop what it called an intrusion of border markers leading to armed conflicts and casualties. An agreement earlier this month to pull back troops and jointly demarcate the border apparently failed. Cameroon says at least 7 of its civilians were killed in border clashes that followed in the southwestern town of Kiosi. But Cameroon's defense minister, Joseph Beti Asomo, on Tuesday said both sides were firm in seeking an end to the border tensions.
Un pays frère, ami. Je ne veux pas citer les liens que nous avons sans
He says the wish of Cameroon's president Paul Biya is to see Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea become the true brotherly and friendly nations that they were at the dawn of independence. He says both countries have sociological, cultural, and geographic relations that should encourage the people of the two states to live in peace and harmony. Despite the agreement's Monday, not all traders along the border were convinced that the skirmishes will end. 40-year-old Cameroonian merchant Angelica Amendi, who buys wine from Equatorial Guinea to sell back home, doubt the border dispute can soon be resolved.
Tous les jours, les deux présidents du Cameroun et de Guinée équatoriale disent qu'on va résoudre ça.
She says she does not think there is a political will to solve the crisis on Cameroon's border with Equatorial Guinea. She says it is not the first time high-profile delegations have met on the instructions of the two heads of state, and the border crisis is yet to end. Equatorial Guinea has often accused Cameroon of not doing enough to stop its citizens and other West Africans from crossing the border illegally. In 2017, Equatorial Guinea sealed its border with Cameroon for 6 months after authorities on both sides arrested heavily armed foreigners and accused them of plotting to overthrow Obiang. The two countries' leaders are Africa's longest-serving presidents. Obiang has ruled Equatorial Guinea since 1979, while Biya has ruled Cameroon since 1982. Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea in 2017 joined 4 other states in the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC, in agreeing to lift visa requirements. Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo have since accused Equatorial Guinea of dragging its feet on allowing the free movement of people and goods. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.
Hey, can you make a 1-minute film on your mobile phone? Do you want to try? Join others who are sending in 60-second videos to the Mobile Film Festival Africa. Films can earn cash grants, and there is a grand prize of 10,000 euros. Some films will be featured on VOA programs. There is one specific rule. Participants must live on the African continent. Submission deadline is July 7th. To find out more and submit your film, visit www.mobilefilmfestival.africa. That's www.